The following podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and major plot spoilers. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another thrilling installment of the King Zone podcast, which is a product of the Super Network. And I am your lovely host, Super Marcy. And with me, as always, is my trusty co-host, Mr. Bead Jermaine. Hello, Bead.
Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Doing well, and how are you?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. You know, just getting on with life as per usual with work and family and such and such. So I've been pretty busy as of late, but I'm also at the moment trying to watch a lot of movies, or at least catch up on a lot of 2019 movies I've been missing, mainly because I'm trying to, over the next few weeks, write up my top 10 films of 2019 list, which I surprisingly still haven't done yet, but usually I like to do that.
I think you mean not surprisingly.
Okay, well, that is true. I usually leave mine very late compared to everyone else because, you know, I want to try to catch up with a lot of movies. I think I remember one year I didn't actually release my list until, like, April.
Yeah, I'm sort of expecting that this time.
Yeah, but I'm going to try to do it as quickly as possible because I only need to see, like, a few more films, you know, like The Lighthouse, A Hidden Life, and a few others, and then, you know, rewatch a couple of things as well, and hopefully I'll try to have them up, but have that written up and published before I go away later in February. And also I got to work on my top 10 horror films of the year list as well for Screamcast, and also finish up on my latest Horror Down Under column, which is taking me quite longer than expected to write. But like I said, a lot of stuff has been happening lately. So
that is true. It has been a very crazy few months both of us.
Yeah, definitely. And so that's sort of, so a bit, my mind's been a bit elsewhere, but I am going to get all the stuff done before I go away. So hopefully they'll all be up and published. And also I got to work on my next bad movie tweet on him, which I'll be doing it on the film The Fanatic, starring John Travolta, which probably had the biggest landslide ever in any of the polls I posted up on the site.
It seemed like maybe one person voted for something else and everyone else just voted for The Fanatic.
Yes, exactly. But and I did finally watch it recently, and it is quite a film, and I'm definitely looking forward to doing my tweet on it, so that should be a lot of fun. But it definitely was kind of the film I expected, but also not expected as well. So so it's definitely a very bizarre little movie, for sure.
I will have to watch it at some point, but I'm very excited for your tweet-a-thon. I'll be on Twitter constantly updating to read your updates. So that should be good.
Yes.
And yeah, so before we get into the nitty-gritty, we'll just want to mention that, obviously, as people probably well aware, Australia's had a very bad bushfire crisis going back to, like, August last year, and unfortunately fires are still burning, and we've just had, like, crazy weather, so a lot of rain came and that helped, and now we're just coming into another, like, I can't think of the word, heat wave. That's the one I'm looking for, so a lot of crazy stuff's going on, and we would like to help any way possible. So myself and a fellow creator called Steve Edwards decided to set up Creators for Bushfire Relief, which you can find on Facebook. There's a page and a group, and we're trying to get together and get some things up for sale. And once they're sold, those proceeds will go to different charities to do with bushfire relief, probably focusing more on the animal side of things, I guess, because that's really just horrible. And there's also an anthology book called Australia Burns, which, fingers crossed, I'll have a short story in. I've got someone drawing it up right now. So if you go to australiaburns.bigcartel.com, you can pre-order it. And I think they're almost at having raised $10,000 just with pre-orders. So it's all pretty good. And yeah, so we'll get into the nitty-gritty. So we are on to episode 7 of the Kingzone podcast. And this one we are covering the Netflix original films. But, Beat, we are not alone for this podcast. We have a first-time guest to any of our podcasts, actually. Mm-hmm. So, very exciting. So, Bede, would you like to do the honours and introduce our guest? Because whenever someone's new, you always have the honours of introducing them.
Of course. For their first time here on the episode, we are introducing a writer who has worked over at the website thedailydead.com and as well has appeared on many of their episodes of their podcast, The Corpse Club, and that, of course, is Tamika Jones. Hello, Tamika.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. How are you guys doing?
Oh, not too bad. Good. How about yourself?
Good. I've had a month. January has been very, very interesting. It's not bad. It's different. And I'm welcoming that. My motto is new year, new decade, new me. So I'm just inviting all of the crazy, hopefully only good crazy, into my life. You know, January, it's okay. It's all over the place. I'm inviting that.
Yeah, January has been quite the month, I think, for everyone, for sure. Not just...
Yeah.
It definitely has in my personal life, but also what's been going on in the world as well. But I suppose if we're going to start off a new decade, we might as well do it with a bang, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like, let's just have our country burn. Let's just introduce a new virus. Let's just have all this weird crap going on.
It's like, ay. Ugh.
It's like okay. We're living in our own, like, end of the world apocalyptic movie.
Right? I don't know. I don't want to say. Maybe I'll save this for after the podcast. My little conspiracy, allegedly, don't come for me.
Ooh, we do love conspiracy theories on this podcast.
We do.
Okay.
I'm just going to say, I'm totally expecting that we're going to be living like Mad Max pretty soon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. I was envisioning maybe like World War Z.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. See, that's part of the conspiracy I have.
Ooh. So I expect...
Yeah, I'm going to save it. I'm...
I think we're going to have like a zombie uprising very soon.
Well, I plan on being a badass survivor, so just saying.
You could be Furiosa, Marcy. But before we get into our episode, I actually have a question to ask Tamika, a very important question. Since this is the Kingzone podcast and you are our first-time guest, I want to ask you, what is your relationship with Stephen King as both as a writer and also the films based on his work? What do you think of them both overall?
Wow. That is a question. Okay, I'm gonna give you an eloquent answer, I promise. Here we go. I absolutely love Stephen King's work. I always have. I, of course, started off with more, I guess, children-friendly horror stories with, like, R.L. Stein. I loved Goosebumps and his Fear Street books. So that was kind of my introduction into horror fiction. And then that graduated to Edgar Allan Poe, and who I'm like kind of slightly obsessed with. And then and then that kind of phased into Stephen King. So I gotta say, I unfortunately I wasn't able to keep up with all of his work. I think the last Stephen King novel I read, I'm not entirely sure the release date, the official release date, but it was definitely the first book in the Mr. Mercedes series. I know it's not Finders Keepers, because I think that's the second book.
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I want to say, I could be very wrong, but I want to say that was back in like 2013, 13, 14, I believe. So I'm a little behind as far as like his current work goes. But I definitely think that reading his work, in a way, even though I didn't necessarily intend to become a horror writer, it helped in the long run because I definitely relate to the characters in his stories who are writers and I think are a reflection of him. And I guess maybe the way that he, like his struggles with writing and especially with writer's block and kind of losing, I guess getting frustrated. And I think for me, that frustration turned into a little bit of, I forget what it's called. I believe it's called, imposter syndrome. That's what it is. So I think for me, I really love those characters because I could relate to them. Like, oh yes, writing is really, really hard, and no one tells you that.
I could agree with that, but particularly with if because Marcy and I write reviews, and Marcy is like the fastest writer I know, and she can knock out a review of anything in like half an hour, hour or so, and it takes me like days until it
Wow.
takes me like a few days to a week to even finish anything. Like I'm like one of the things I'm working on at the moment, which is my next horror Down Under column, which I've been writing on and off for about a month now, so. I'm like one of the slowest writers. Although I wish I had like Stephen King's drive where he can like literally write like five books in the 1 year if he wanted to.
It was cocaine bead, let's just be
Well, that is true. Maybe I just need to take cocaine. Lots and
Maybe
lots of
need
cocaine.
the cocaine because like he doesn't even remember writing half the shit he wrote back in the 80s.
Exactly.
What's the one with the Mack truck with the demon face on it?
Oh,
The
Maximum
front,
Overdrive. Or
Maximum Overdrive. Yes,
Easy. I'm.
I think maybe that came from like a coked out fever dream.
Well, he doesn't even remember directing that movie.
Wow,
And
that's amazing.
we'll definitely be talking about that on a future episode of the King's Own podcast. But
Yes, we will.
Tamika, what about in regards to the movies themselves? Of like, what would be some of your favorite Stephen King films?
Oh, it's like picking a child because even the ones that people really don't care for collectively, I really enjoy for like probably the reasons why they don't like them. Like, I revisit Sleepwalkers a lot. I just, it's just, oh, I wish I don't want to like take up all of your lovely recording time with just how much I enjoyed that movie. But like cat people, aliens, cat aliens, I have no idea what those creatures are, but I think if I had to make a top three, is it bizarre to say that Sleepwalkers is maybe like two?
Not at
Not
all.
at all.
Okay. Ooh. What's number one and three? Oh, that's tough. Oh, that's well, I mean, The Shining. Ooh.
Which is fair.
Okay. Okay, I'm gonna say Gerald's Game, I would put it number three,
Ooh.
and The Shining, I would put it number one. So
Awesome.
that's kind of weird. I know. The Shining is Sleepwalkers.
I gotta have a lot of. I mean, I've always been mixed on Sleepwalkers myself because even though it is a batshit insane little movie, but I gotta respect for putting it number two as one of your all-time favorite Stephen King at
Yes.
properties. Because that is a
Yeah,
movie.
full respect.
Yeah, because that's an original script that he wrote when he wasn't on cocaine, so.
Wow, okay. That's
But yes, but we'll move right along to the topic at hand, Tamika.
Yes, we will. So, as previously mentioned, we will be discussing the Netflix original movies that have been adapted from Stephen King works. The first movie we'll be discussing is 1922 from 2017.
1922. A man's pride was a man's land. And so was his son. My wife. She wanted us to leave all this behind.
We can move.
Our cities are for fools.
We divorce. We both know that's what you want. Life is rarely fair, especially out here.
And I believe that there's another man inside every man. Conniving man.
I'm gonna sell. You, my son, are coming with me.
This is our house. In 1922, I murdered my wife.
Want a glass of lemonade, Sheriff?
Can I look in the house?
She only took the one suitcase.
Woman, that'd be crazy to leave a nice house like this one.
And this is based on the novella of the same name. And the film was directed by Zach Hilditch, I believe,
yep,
is how you say his name.
Mm-hmm.
Starring Thomas Jane and Molly Parker. And just a simple synopsis from IMDb. A simple yet proud farmer in the year 1922 conspires to murder his wife for financial gain, convincing his teenage son to assist. But their actions have unintended consequences. So that does sound like a very disturbing little number. And after watching it, yes, yes, it is a little bit. So I think for as per discussions per each film, I'll let Bede kick this one off with his thoughts on 1922 from 1917. Just had to make sure I got that right.
2007.
2070. Not 2007.
There's just too many years we're getting. There's too many. This movie is like getting all of our years mixed up. but in regards to 1922, I really like this movie a lot. I haven't read the novella that the film is based on, but I know it's from, I think, Stephen King's novella collection, Full Dark, No Stars, which, funnily enough, has two other stories in it that were adapted into films, which we'll definitely cover on the King's Own podcast in future episodes, which are A Good Marriage and Big Driver. And so I don't know how to sort of... So I have nothing to compare with, you know, the original story since I've read it, but as a film on its own, I really like this film a lot. And I like that it's sort of this sort of slow burn, kind of very atmospheric and creepy sort of ghost story. In a way, it kind of reminded me of, funnily enough, Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart, which...
Big time.
Which is basically, I guess it would be, this is King's take on that story with, you know, you have Thomas James, who plays Wilfred James, who and his son murder his wife, as you said, played by... Arlette, who is played by Molly Parker, and then sort of the repercussions of that sort of start to affect them over the course of a year, and all these different things happen to them. And one of the main ones is that rats start infesting the farm. And then over the course of the story, you're kind of not sure whether everything is happening, or at least like sort of the supernatural stuff is actually supernatural, or if it's all in Wilfred's head, whether it's his kind of eating away at him for what he is.
For me, personally, it felt like it was a representation of his guilt eating away at him. And I think it was very well done, very clever. And an interesting kind of, I guess, way to tell a Telltale Heart type story, even with a bit of a sort of Bonnie and Clyde bit thrown in, like, the third act, which was very interesting. I guess kind of as a repercussion of that guilt.
Yeah, and it's and I like how, like I said before, it is a slow burn. Like, there are some really creepy moments in it, but Zach Hilditch, who is actually an Australian, and this is his second film. He wrote, previously wrote and directed, prior to this one, the end-of-the-world drama, These Final Hours, which is a pretty solid debut, so if anyone hasn't seen that, definitely check it out.
I have not seen it.
But,
I don't do well with end-of-the-world scenario films. That's one of the things that scares me way too much, and I think it just, movies like that tend to break me, so that's why I haven't watched it, as good as it looks.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good film, but it is a very heavy and dark film as well. So him tackling, like, a Stephen King story definitely is definitely not out of his wheelhouse, because, like I said, 1922 is a pretty dark story, and
it deals
with some dark elements, and there's even some really disturbing imagery. Like, having sort of rewatched it recently, I forgot there's a scene where Wilfred is, like, asleep one night, and he hears the cows mooing really loudly in the barn. He goes out there and he finds, like, this rat just eating away at one of a cow's udder, which is, like, a really kind of creepy little sort of moment. Like, it happens so quickly, but it's one of those kind of moments that kind of chills you. And also the atmosphere, it's just, it's so beautifully shot as well, and the score is great, and it's a ghost story that doesn't rely on jump scares. It's more using atmosphere and dread to kind of convey the creepiness of what's happening.
Definitely, and this movie really don't like the cows.
Really, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. There is a scene where a cow goes down a well.
There's a hole in my heart, as deep as the well, for that poor little boy who's stuck halfway to hell.
Though we can't get him out, we'll do the next best thing.
We'll go on TV and sing, sing, sing.
And we're sending our love down the well.
All the way down.
We're sending our love down the well.
Down that well.
Sending
it's weird.
Down the well. Oh wait, sorry, wrong song.
it's really weird. It's messed up, and yeah, I did not like seeing those poor cows get hurt.
Exactly.
I'm with you.
And what did
it's interesting,
think?
Because, like, sorry. It seems like Stephen King has a pattern. Like, there's usually a story about like the middle of nowhere, but, like, there's, like, a cornfield or, like, grass or something, like, you know, like, it's interesting. That and some sort of, like animal, not hurting animals, but there's always some kind of, like, horrifying, like, animal imagery. So I feel like it kind of fits in.
And what did you think of 1922 overall, Tamika?
I really enjoy the film. I like that, although the premise is rather simple, Stephen King, as usual, can take that and make so much out of it, and you're still able to follow it and be completely immersed in what's going on. And so, yeah, I really enjoy the film overall. There's two things that I kind of can't, well, there are two moments that I kind of don't really enjoy so much, but it didn't ruin my enjoyment of the film in any way. I love Thomas Jane's performance. He's definitely a standout for me in the film, and definitely a memorable character. And yeah, I'm definitely with Marcy. The cow stuff, it's like, why, Stephen King? Why with the animals? Why every time? time. It's a cat or a rat or a cow, something.
But then they have all the rats as well, which rats can be pretty creepy as well.
There's a lot of rats.
And I like how it's sort of like one of those stories, like sort of watching it, there's definitely elements of like other previous King work in here as well. Like you know, you got the cornfields and they're like from Children of the Corn, and you got a well, which has been used a lot in previous works as well. And, you know, rats as graveyard shift, let's not forget. but I think it's
graveyard shift.
But like Tamika said, like, and I wholeheartedly agree with, like, it is a very simple story, but he just brings so much to it in terms of character and what they're going through, and also sort of the themes that he tackles with the story as well. And Thomas Jane is just great in the movie. Like, even though watching the movie, he just looks so much like Jim Varney that it kind of creeped me out. and also, like, he does...
So, like, Ernest Goes Farming?
Exactly.
Ernest Goes Farming.
And also, like, he's probably puts on the best mumble performance since, like, Jeff Bridges in True Grit.
Because
half the time I have to, like, put the subtitles on because what the hell is he saying?
Yeah, I watched this with subtitles. I was like, nah, I can't do it. I can't hear him. Subtitles. Yeah, pretty much.
But also, like, even the supporting cast are really good. Like, Molly Parker's really solid as, you know, as the wife Arlette. And also Neil McDonough, who's an actor who... I was convinced for the longest time only appeared in shit movies because he seemed like every bad movie I'd seen, he was like in it.
I was stunned, and I was going to bring this up, but you already have, so that's fine. I was stunned he was in this. I'm like, holy shit, it's Neil McDonough, and he's not in a bad movie. Like, what the? And he was really, really good. Like, with, you know, if he's given good material, he can be a great actor. He just needs to stay away from, like, Balloon Farm, I Know Who Killed Me, Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li, and numerous other crap.
In Neil McDonough's honor, he was, I don't know if the two of you have ever watched the show Justified. It ran on FX, I think, I want to say like 5-6 seasons. He was lovely on that show, and I promise it's not a bad show. I was about to swear, and I wasn't sure if I could, so I didn't.
Yes, you can. I have seen like maybe 2 seasons of that show, but it's been a while.
I know.
The one I was meaning to like actually finish.
Yeah, I know. Vincent. That show was so good. And as usual, he was a bad guy, but he was a wonderful bad guy.
Which is good. I think there needs to be more appreciation for Neil McDonough. He's pretty cool. And in this film, he plays like their neighbor, and his daughter is in a relationship with Thomas Jane's son. And that leads to its whole little interesting subplot in the movie, which I mentioned earlier, the Bonnie and Clyde type thing. But I guess, like, for me, I agree with pretty much everything you both have said. Like, it's a damn good movie. It's simple, it's a slow burn, and yeah, it does have a lot of different like inspirations and elements, but I just love that it's kind of like this breakdown of guilt in the end, and I think it works really, really well. And the rats and the way the rats are is especially a really good like metaphor for that guilt, because once they do kill the wife, everything just goes downhill. And you can tell, like, he's, you know, Wilfred is a man who's definitely full of regret with what he's done, and that has really bad consequences for their son as well.
Indeed.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Like, I was... Oh, okay. I didn't want to talk at the same time as someone else. I fear... that I might derail the conversation, but I'm just curious. What did you guys make of the Bonnie and Clyde type storyline, because I feel like it was definitely going down the path of a Telltale Heart, you know, and about somebody's psyche breaking down after doing something really heinous and that guilt eating them up. And then I feel like it just took a turn into something else for a while. Like, what did you guys make of that? Or maybe I'm missing something. I think I'm missing something.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. It sort of did go in a different direction than what I guess I was expecting with how the movie was up until that point. But for me, like, it made sense in a way with these two characters, like with everything that was happening to them. And of course, like that guilt, and it just felt like, especially like the son, Henry, was just pretty much like, just had lost the plot. And that's just, I guess, the way he saw as a way out of that situation that he was in at home, but he couldn't really fix it and what he was doing. And it just felt like even he knew, I think deep down, it was just a hopeless battle. Beat?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I thought it was, I think it's also kind of tackling what was going on at the time as well, because I think, yeah, Bonnie and Clyde did their crime spree, I believe, in the 1920s, and there were other sort of bandits and everything around that time as well. So it's kind of like, in a way, kind of show what was going on in America at that sort of, during that decade, by having that sort of little subplot with Henry and his girlfriend becoming bandits themselves. But also, like, as you said, it's kind of shows, like, the repercussions of, like, what they did. Even though it was, Wilfred was the one who actually murdered Arlette, Henry did aid him, and even then, throughout the most of the story, he's being eaten away by it as well. Probably not at the extent of his dad, but given that, you know, what happens to his girlfriend when he finds out that she's pregnant, and then she is going to be sent off to, like, a nunnery until the baby's born, and then the baby's going to be put up for adoption. Like, he definitely has a sense of rightness about him, and wanting to do the right thing, and wanting to be there for his girlfriend and also the baby. And this was the only, and since he couldn't get the money to do it, like, you know, have a new life and everything like that, he had to resort to stealing, which does make sense within the story as well, and also kind of showing Wilfred, like, because of his actions, like, pretty much everything around him has been destroyed. Like, his farm is falling apart by the end of it. Rats have pretty much taken over everything. And his son is dead. His neighbor's daughter is dead. And, like, it just showing, like, the actions of one terrible thing can do so much. And there's an interesting line in the movie that I found interesting. Like, I think along the lines, like, I'm paraphrasing, so it's probably not exactly what the movie says. It's like he sort of says during his narration that God kind of sort of gives rewards to people who do good, but the devil also rewards people who do evil. And for a little while there, like, everything is going good, like, their crops are going good and everything like that, but then the universe kind of stepped in and kind of righting the wrongs of what happened by pretty much showing Wilfred, like, what his actions have consequences and pretty much destroy everything. And as we see by the very end, his no matter where he goes, the rats still follow him. And then, of course, finally, the ghosts of those who were killed by his actions come back pretty much to have their retribution in the end.
Okay.
Which is a pretty good visual for the ending as well, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we'll wrap up our 1922 from 2017 discussion, as we normally do with the King Zone. We'll give a rating out of 5 for each film. So for me, I would rate this movie a 4 out of 5. Because I think it's really damn good. And one thing I just forgot to add is that the look and feel of the movie it feels very authentic to the time period, which I thought was just excellent as well. And that definitely adds to me giving it that score. Bede, what would your rating be?
I give it about 4 out of 5 as well. And I also want to mention, like, which I just remembered just now, is that the score of the film is done by Mike Patton, who is a member of the band Faith No More. So he did the score for this film as well. And it's a pretty damn good...
It's a good score, yeah.
Yeah, very good and haunting score as well. And so, yeah, 4 out of 5 for me. I think it's a surprisingly damn good one. And definitely a very underrated Stephen King film adaptation for sure.
And so, Mika, what is your rating out of 5?
Ooh, okay. I'm going to give it... a 4.2 out of 5. I'm giving it the 0.2 because I forgot to mention how beautiful the film is. There were moments where I felt like I could touch like the sweat on people's like on like someone's like brow or like their forehead or something. It just like you could just feel the environment, and it just felt so hot and just overbearing. And I just love stuff like that. So, can I change it? Awesome. Is that possible?
You can.
Okay. I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5.
4.5.
3 extra points for sweat.
Yes. Or sweat.
Or sweat. All right, so that wraps up our discussion on 1922, which you can watch on Netflix, of course. And on to our next film up for discussion is Gerald's Game, also from 2017.
This is going to be good for us, Jess, really good.
That's a marriage, isn't it? Working on the difficult things.
For better or worse.
Let's go in, get comfy.
I bet you think your husband will be back any minute. Try to go for help. There's no one for miles.
Gerald?
I'm sorry, baby. You don't get to know my name.
I don't like this. I'm serious. Stop.
I'm like that. Thanks.
Stop it!
Are you playing?
Is this really what it takes these days?
God, how did we go so wrong? We were happy once, weren't we?
Gerald?
What?
What's happening? Oh. Gerald! Time to wake up, honey.
5 hours you've wasted screaming for neighbors that are half a mile away, if they're even here yet. How long do you think someone lives without water? That will not work. No. You can pull till your wrists break. You're not getting out of those cuffs.
Not real. Little baby, don't say a word.
Focus. You've been sleepwalking since you were 12 years old.
That's a beautiful dress.
He put you in those handcuffs way before Gerald did.
You all right? You all right, Mom?
You need everything you need to survive from the beginning. You just have to remember.
Back off!
If you don't wake up, you're gonna die.
And this one was directed by Mike Flanagan, and it stars, I can always get a name wrong, Carla Gugino.
Yes.
And yes. Bruce Greenwood. And the short synopsis on IMDb, a couple tries to spice up their marriage in a remote lake house. After the husband dies unexpectedly, the wife is left handcuffed to their bed frame and must fight to survive and break free. So, actually, as with all these films, I only just watched them all recently because I hadn't seen them before. So it was quite an interesting week last week watching everything. And this one was the one I saved until last because, like, I'd heard such good things about it and I was very excited to see it. But the premise was just like, how could they make a movie where someone is handcuffed to a bed for, like, the whole thing? But watching this all unfold, I was very shocked and surprised. And I haven't read what it's based on, but I had heard things like it's unfilmable and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, holy crap. Like, Mike Flanagan specifically has crafted, like, a really interesting and at times quite horrific film. And there's, again, it's a simple story. A woman is left handcuffed to the bed because her husband had too much Viagra and had a heart attack and died. And, yeah, it's definitely about a fight for survival, but also her kind of revisiting things from her life that maybe led her to that point. So it's very interesting. And before I discuss the movie any further, I'm just going to add that I'm a big fan of Bruce Greenwood. I think he's fantastic. And, oh, my God, he was ripped in this movie. I just could not even deal. When he took his shirt off, I'm like, "Meh, what? Dude, how?" Like, whoa.
Mind you, Bruce Greenwood is now 63 years old, so.
I'm going to say, he's like in his early 60s, and I'm like, dude, I'd probably still go there. I don't care if you're 30 years older than me, whatever. Sorry, just kind of had to be said. But yeah, since Tamika, you named this as, like, I guess in your top three for Stephen King adaptations, why don't you tell us your thoughts on Gerald's Game?
Sure. First, I actually have read the story that this film is based on, and I did have some reservations about how they were going to pull certain things off, because what works written down on paper doesn't necessarily translate to film, and a lot of the internal, like, a lot of her internal thoughts, I thought, I don't know how this is going to work, but I really enjoy Mike Flanagan's work. I had seen Hush, which I believe came out the year prior. I'm usually really great at release dates, but for some reason, I'm like blanking this go round.
Yes, Hush was 2016.
Oh, yes.
Which was also a damn good Netflix original movie.
So, so good. So I thought if anyone could pull this off, I definitely had faith in him. And I think he did a really good job pulling it off because, yeah, I mean, how do you keep someone's interest, or even whether it's like even to pique their interest or just keep their interest when so much of the movie takes place in largely in one space? Mm-hmm. But I think that it definitely is as thrilling and captivating as the story itself. And I certainly was really freaked out. Are we allowed to talk spoilers? Or
yes.
Oh, okay. when the serial grave robber shows up, is
the
when
moon man?
Yes.
What do they
yes.
call him? The Moonlight Man.
Yes, that's it. I think he started off at, like, robbing graves, and then he like escalated to assaulting his victims. So I was so creeped out by that, those moments, and I felt just as paralyzed. I definitely am really creeped out by just even the hint of stuff, like what possibly could have happened to her. And I'm also very afraid of home invasion type stories. So it just hit me in my heart on so many levels.
Yeah, I don't think we'd want to wake up in the middle of the night and see the Moonlight Man in the bedroom.
No.
He was very creepy. I do have a question because you have read it. So once she's cuffed to the bed and he dies, and then, like, I guess it's like her conscious and thoughts manifest into her seeing him, but also herself. In the book, is that just like her inner monologue, or does she see them as, like, I guess, I don't know if you want to say hallucinations or manifestations of her, I guess, subconsciousness?
I definitely took it to be meant like they're sometimes hallucinations, and in other times what's happening is real, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Are you asking if, like, if that character is real?
Like, in the book, when she sees... No, when she sees, like, her dead husband walking around and talking to her, does that happen in the book, or is that, like, her talking to herself, I guess? I'm trying to get at that.
Oh. Yeah. I see what you're saying. It is more of her kind of, like, talking, having these conversations with herself, which is why I think that works. I thought, well, I don't know how that's going to work in the film, because that just seems, I don't know, that just seems kind of strange, even though I know that most of us do that, but like, there has to be some sort of, I guess, artistic way to show that. So it definitely makes more sense to have him appear to her and, you know, for them to have conversations than it just be her chained to a bed, like, you know, like, God, how did I get here, you know?
Yeah. So in that respect, I think it was quite clever to have her kind of see him, and she sees herself as well, and she speaks with herself as, like, I guess her manifestations of, I guess what I said before, like her subconsciousness telling her what to do or what's going on, like, all her feelings about it. And there's even parts where obviously it goes into her flashbacking to when she was like 12 or so, and the sort of tragic thing that happens between her and her father, which was very disturbing, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, the actress who played the younger version of Jessie, I think her name's Kiara Oriella. She was really good.
Oh, absolutely. I imagine it's got to be tough. I mean, it's tough as an adult to pull off certain scenes like that, but I can't even imagine what it's, you know, a child her age is thinking, trying to process those kinds of scenes.
Yeah, it's very confronting, that's for sure. And, another interesting role for Henry Thomas, playing the father in the flashbacks. And he, of course, was in some of Mike Flanagan's other works with Dr. Sleep and The Haunting of Hill House. Yeah, so, yeah, definitely a really interesting cast, that's for sure.
And it's kind of nice. I mean, we obviously know... we're familiar, I should say, with Carla and Bruce, but I think the general public, maybe not so much. So it's a nice platform for them to, you know, show off their talents and really kind of get themselves into the mindset of these characters and really show, you know, what they can do to, you know, the average audience. And I don't mean average in like in a bad way in any way, but just like an audience that maybe isn't familiar with them or isn't familiar with, you know, every Stephen King story or this particular story. Such a great role, you know, like such great roles for them to really like dig their teeth into.
Yeah, they are both like fantastic in this film. In obviously different ways, but she especially just goes through a lot in this. Bede, do you want to chime in with your thoughts on Gerald's Game, which this is the one you've been telling me to watch for ages, and you talked about it a lot, and you told me that this movie had a scene that is just so hard for you to watch, and I was so curious about it. And when I finally saw it, I was like, yeah, I can see why. It doesn't affect me as much as it affects you, but yeesh.
But before I get to that scene, just my overall thoughts on the film. I really love Gerald's Game. Like, I loved it the first time I watched it, and having rewatched it again in prep for this episode, I think I loved it even more on the second watch because, like, it is a very simple premise, but it's one that could, if it's not done in the right hands, it could not have worked at all. But Mike Flanagan just made it absolutely work because, like, I've read up sort of what the book is about, and again, a lot of it is kind of more inner monologue. So the fact that he kind of found a way to make that work on screen by having sort of, like, instead of just, you know, the character of Jesse just talking to herself throughout the whole movie, he did that by having, you know, Bruce Greenwood being playing like the voice, one of the voices, like the voice of her husband, and also herself as another voice as well, and kind of have bouncing off them.
Yeah, it was kind of like when you think about, like, specifically in like those old cartoons where someone would be talking to their consciousness and they'd have like the angel and the devil.
Yeah.
It was kind of like that with her husband being more the devil and her being more the angel, because she speaks to him and he's like that negative side. When she speaks to herself, she's the helpful side. So I really liked how that played out like that.
Mm. And what I really, yeah, I agree. And then also like how they sort of, in a way, even like, even though Gerald, at least the voice of Gerald, is kind of putting her down and stuff like that, saying that she's not going to make it. But even then, there's a way he finds a way to help her as well, or at least kind of deal with things from her own past and what their relationship as a couple was like, or things she kind of ignored and then kind of confronting about it. So that to me was what kind of really got me emotionally about the film, is that it is a story about confronting one's past and like where events would happen to us, and say with Jesse, with her father molesting her, like how those events kind of shaped her life and where it led to that moment of her being chained on the bed, and like her sort of confronting that, dealing with it, and then moving on as well. So in a way, and it's kind of interesting because this movie kind of came out just around the same time as the Me Too movement was starting to kick into gear. So there's a lot of those kind of aspects in the film as well. And I just felt like the movie did a really great way of sort of tackling these themes in a way that's still disturbing and confronting, but also done in a way that's tasteful as well, and not doing it as exploitative, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
But, I mean, Carla Gugino, I've always been a fan of Carla Gugino. She's just one of those underrated actresses who always gives strong work no matter what film or TV show she's in. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is like, without a doubt, the performance of her career. She's just absolutely amazing in this film. And Bruce Greenwood is terrific as well. And her character goes through a lot. She does. And she just lights up the screen, and you just really sort of get taken in by her character and what she's going through and sort of the layers that the film kind of reveals about her as well. And also, I also like the little touches. And also, the film is also very creepy, and I like the fact that there's barely a score in this film. Like, there is a score in it, but it's only used when it's appropriate. And most of the time, it's Mike Flanagan uses sound effects to kind of give off the sort of the creepiness of what's happening, especially the night scenes where it's just like sounds. And then I also like that for most part, until you find out that the Moonlight Man is an actual real person, you think, oh, is there something supernatural going on as well? And I really like that sort of how the film does, watching it, at least when you watch it the first time, you think, oh, something, there's a ghost or something in this house. And then when you find out it's real, it kind of surprised you. And then when you, now having rewatched it again, I can definitely see like how Mike Flanagan sort of did that in a way to kind of fool the audience into convincing us to think that there was something supernatural going on when
yeah, there like
wasn't. It's believable and plausible as well.
Yeah, there is a line where she's sort of having that discussion with herself in the form of her dead husband, where he says something about that the Moonlight Man is death coming for her. And you sort of think like, oh, maybe that's what it is. But then you find out it is a real person.
Mm.
It's like, holy shit.
Mm. And it's played by the actor who played Lurch in the Addams Family movies. Which
yes, of... and you never knew that this actor was also Lurch.
I did not know that. But the thing was, I didn't realize he was Lurch in the Addams. I'm trying to pronounce... I think it's Karel Struljek. I probably butchered his name, so forgive me. But the thing was, I kind of noticed him right away because I think at the time before I watched this movie, I just started watching Twin Peaks for the first time and he played the giant in that. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, he's in this movie too. And that was kind of that weird thing. I watched the first two seasons and like nearly every second film or TV show I was watching, I was like, oh, that person was in Twin Peaks. That person was in Twin Peaks. So it was kind of a weird thing.
I remember when we watched Doctor Sleep and you're like, oh, he's the Moonlight Man in Gerald's Game. And I'm like, B, that's Lurch from the Addams Family. And like, what?
And I'm like, what?
It's Lurch.
Well, to be fair, I am like, a bit...
mind blown.
To be fair, I am a bit slow. Let's just admit that. But also, like...
And he was also in Star Trek, The Next Generation, just saying.
Ah, yes, that's right. Also, I do like... when it kind of tackles like child abuse, I thought the film did a really good job at handling that. Particularly the, like, I think the young girl, like you were saying, Chiara Oriella, I probably butchered her name as well, so forgive me. She's just phenomenal. And the scene between her and Henry Thomas, as he's basically manipulating her not to say anything to anyone by using that, but like, oh, we better tell your mother. But she's like, doesn't want to say anything. And it's interesting how that kind of, the movie kind of uses tackles like manipulation and also gaslighting as well.
That scene was just so uncomfortable and you just want to beat the shit out of her dad.
Yes.
And I also like the little nods to other Stephen King work in this movie, like Cujo gets name dropped.
It does, yes.
Also Bag of Bones gets name dropped as well because she says like the Moonlight Man carries around a bag of bones. But also, there's an interesting thing I didn't realize this, at least the first time I watched the film, is that, you know the scene where she, because the movie's set during, or at least younger Jesse, it's set during, when we go to the flashbacks, it's all the stuff with her dad's happening as a solar eclipse is happening. And she talks about later that she had a dream that night about a woman being sucked down the bottom of a well and a woman staring down at her. Apparently, that she's referring to Dolores Claiborne. Because that happens in that as well. And I was just reading on the book page is that Stephen King actually deliberately started out writing Gerald's Game as a companion piece to Dolores Claiborne as being two stories about women whose lives were affected around a solar eclipse. But it kind of changed as the book was as he went up. But it kind of changed for Gerald's Game as the book went along. So I'm not sure if that aspect is still in the book or not, but I think if it wasn't, I think that was kind of Mike Flanagan of throwing that in there as kind of linking the two stories. And also, speaking of Hush, there's a reference to Hush in this movie as well, because the book that Jesse throws at the dog is a book called Midnight Mass.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the book that the main character from Hush actually wrote. So not only is this set in the Stephen King universe, it's set in the same universe as Hush.
Yes. It's set in the Mike Flanagan universe.
Yes. And also, like, Mike Flanagan. And Mike Flanagan's next project is, in a way, his film version of that book called Midnight Mass. And he threw it in there as kind of like a, like, references to a future work that he's going to work on.
That is so neat.
But to me, what makes this film quite memorable, and this is what you were referring to earlier, Marcy, is a scene that I like to call the gloving scene. Now, I know a lot of people, when they kind of have those kind of things you know, like we all have those kind of things when we watch a movie that really grosses us out. Like some people have like something happening to eyes or fingernails.
Yeah, that's me.
Or
eyes and brains I can't deal with.
Or fingernails or teeth and stuff like that. We have those things like
other parts
of the body we don't have a problem with, but with certain body parts, any kind of damage that happens to them, we kind of freak out. For me, it's wrists. So anytime like a movie where it shows somebody like slitting their wrists or something happening to their wrists, it freaks me out. And I literally like my hands start, I'm even doing it right now. I'm actually holding my wrist right now because it actually creeps me out so much that I'm literally holding them right now because it's like a nervous kind of tick. I don't know what it is about it, but it freaks me out so much that I, so when the film does this thing, because there's this, because the movie's up to a certain point is trying, Jesse is trying to figure out how she's going to escape from the handcuffs. So she comes up with a plan of using her blood, because blood can, and I knew about this because blood can also be kind of a lubricant. So as I'm thinking, okay, so she's going to cut her wrists and use the blood to kind of slip out of the handcuffs. That's what I thought the movie was going to do, but it goes a little bit further than that. So not only does she cut her wrist, she cuts up her, like her palm, and then she goes to get the hand out of the handcuffs and her skin starts peeling away and you see like the muscle,
everything,
and the bones, and like, and no joke, I was already freaking out when the wrist part, but this sent me in overdrive mode when that scene happened, because I literally started like having a very visceral reaction to that scene. I was like, I think I let out a like, oh fuck no, fuck no, fuck. And I was like, nope, I'm done. And then came back and watched the movie after that. But yeah, that scene really did my head over, and even thinking about it now, it still sends chills down my spine. So that pretty much got such a reaction from me, and it's very rare for a movie to kind of get such a visceral reaction out of me, but this film managed to do that. So I got to give Mike Flanagan props for creating one of the most chilling scenes I have seen in a film in the past few years.
It is so graphic, and it is like, ugh, yuck. It's just like, ugh. I think of other ways I would have got out of those handcuffs.
Yes. I'd have been like, I'd rather the dog eat me than get out of the handcuffs that way.
What? Really? I don't know. I don't know.
How do you feel about that scene, Tamika?
I mean,
how it does definitely it gives to, me. I mean, sorry to interrupt, but how does it compare to? I was going to say, compare to the book? Because I know it happens in the book as well. How does it compare to, like, how Stephen King wrote it, to like how it's visually represented?
I think I think that Mike did a fantastic job, because Stephen King is a really great way of describing things. It's almost kind of like methodical. Sometimes he can describe things in too much detail, if that even makes sense. But there's something about seeing it, like actually seeing like the skin start to like peel back. And it just reminds me of just like a Saw movie. Like, I can't do a lot of those movies for similar reasons. And I started to get lightheaded. That's how intense that moment was for me. So no, I don't think that you're alone at all, because like the wrist, like I'm okay with things like that. Even it depends on eye stuff. I don't know. It depends on what you do. But when skin and bone and muscle is involved, and you just see it like just peel back almost like a banana, it's just like, oh no, 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 like I'm done. But I think, I mean, obviously there's no way for me to like really know if I would do this or not, but I definitely would choose the like peeling back my skin to get my hand out of that handcuff than to have a dog eat me, for sure. I don't know, I
probably would have been strong enough to break the bedposts. Just saying.
Ooh.
Like, I love the Saw movies. I've seen them all many times, and like, I've worked out how to get out of those like traps, and it's almost like a messed up saw trap. And it's like, no, I would not like saw through my limbs. I'd find another way. There's always another way. And I'm like, no, I'd break those fucking bedposts and get the fuck out. Just saying. So, I guess with that lovely, wonderful scene, that kind of wraps up our discussion of Gerald's Game. We'll do ratings once again. So my rating for this movie is 4.5 out of 5. I think it's that damn good. That damn fantastic. And, you know, Mike Flanagan is definitely becoming like a director to watch. I've seen, I think, most of his films, but I'm going to go back and watch some of his early ones that I haven't seen. But yeah, he's definitely becoming a really solid name in the horror genre. And it's really good to see that he's made two fantastic Stephen King adaptations. So well done. Bede, what are your ratings and closing thoughts?
I'm definitely giving it 4.5 as well. I think Mike Flanagan, for me, I've seen all of his work so far. I mean, I still haven't got around to watching Haunting of Hill House yet, but I've been meaning to. But for me,
yeah, that's probably next to watch for me. Yeah.
But for me, he's definitely becoming one of my favorite modern horror directors, because he always finds a way to sort of bring the scares and the chills. But he's someone who's really more focused on theme and character as well. Because he knows that, you know, like Stephen King, if you want the horror to be as effective as it is, you need to have characters you care about and also deal with topics and themes that we as people can relate to on a number of levels. And the fact that he's a guy who's somehow has taken things that shouldn't work and somehow makes it does. Like, I mean, he's taken a book like Gerald's Game, which is for many people considered unfilmable, to make it into a great film. And then, of course, afterwards he would make Doctor Sleep, which is what people are like, how is a sequel to both Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining and also Stephen King's book, how's that going to work? And he found a way to do that. But also, most importantly, he somehow made a pretty kick-ass prequel to a horror film that, for a lot of people, was like one of the worst horror films of this decade, and that, of course, is Ouija, Origin of Evil, which he somehow made a film that was...
That's a pretty good movie.
Yeah, so...
It's really enjoyable.
Yeah, and like, he's just a great director, and I can't wait to see more work of him. And I can't wait till when we tackle his other Stephen King project, Doctor Sleep, in a future episode as well.
Yes, finally. Tamika, what is your rating and final thoughts?
I definitely would give this film a 5 out of 5.
Ooh.
And yeah, I know, but I mean... No, I don't even hesitate with that, because I feel like I always hesitate to give something a 5 out of 5, because that means that I'm saying that it's like perfect. But I kind of I agree. I think it is a perfect movie. It is slow when it needs to be, and then it picks up the pace, and especially once certain things get kind of revealed, the pacing starts to kind of rev up a little bit, but you never feel lost in the story, and the characters are just so well thought out and well portrayed, and it's creepy when it needs to be and kind of sweet and sad. It just makes my heart feel really good, and I hope that doesn't seem like sound weird.
But it's also going to be, for someone who loves the book, seeing an actual great adaptation. Because I think that's something like...
Yes.
I mean, we all love certain books or comics and stuff, and we kind of think, oh, if this gets turned into a movie, is this going to be good? But when you have something that's a movie that's just as good as the book, or even better, then that's even more of a thrill.
That's so beautifully said. Thank you very much for that. Because that, what he said... All of the beautiful things that
and yeah, I guess that wraps up our discussion of Gerald's Game
and
Gerald's abs, yes. And with that said, that will lead us to the final Netflix original film we'll be discussing. which is In the Tall Grass, 2019.
Did you hear that?
Someone out there? Help me! Help
me! Cal? Becky!
Something's not right about this. I think we should head back to the road.
Becky?
Travis?
Who are you? What's going on?
I came looking for you!
What?
How did you get here before us?
I don't know.
My boy, he's lost in here too.
This is nuts!
It's only a feeling.
What's happening?
He went the other way! No!
I'm never gonna find her.
You can find things, but it's easier once they're dead.
How long have we been here?
I'm not sure.
That sounded like me.
This field doesn't make any sense.
Name one thing in here that does.
Just chance? We're all here for a reason.
Becky!
Oh my god.
It's grass. It's just grass.
This one was written and directed by Vincenzo Natali, and this is based on the novella by Stephen King and his son, Joe Hill. So a little bit different with an adaptation because it's by Stephen King and his son, and Joe Hill is a magnificent writer in his own right. And I have read one of his books, which was Horns, and I highly recommend it. It's fantastic. So the IMDb synopsis for In the Tall Grass. After hearing a young boy's cry for help, a sister and brother venture into a vast field of tall grass in Kansas, but soon discover there may be no way out and that something evil lurks within. So I guess I'll start off discussing this one. I guess going into this, I kind of heard mixed things, like some people liked it, some people didn't. I didn't really let that affect me when going into the movie. Like, I usually don't. I go in clear-headed. What got me excited was that was written and directed by Vincenzo Natali, who I absolutely love and adore. He was, of course, behind Cube and Splice, and he worked on... God, my brain hurts. He directed episodes of Hannibal, the TV series, and they were just tremendous. And he's been doing quite a bit of TV work with directing episodes. He's done Luke Cage, The Strain, Lost in Space, and he'll be working on Lock and Key. So, yeah, he's been keeping busy, and he's a really interesting and stylistic director. And this sort of story... actually, I think, really suited him. And I think we were kind of discussing this just on text after you watched it as well, Bede, that it kind of does have a lot of Cube elements, which I think works for him telling this story. So basically you've got Becky and Cal, played by, I think it's Laisla de Oliveira and Avery Whithead. They're like the brother and a sister who end up going into this tall grass because they hear the screams of a young boy called Tobin, played by, I think it's Will Bowie Jr. God, I'm just ruining names. But like once they're in there, pretty soon it just seems like they're running around in circles. This kid looks like he's been in there for ages and he's messed up, and all these weird things just start happening, and it becomes very clear like there's something going on in this field within this grass. And sort of as it progressed, for me I was getting a bit of like a H.P. Lovecraft type vibe from it and what was going on. And I thought like it had pretty decent performances. I really liked, and I always do, Patrick Wilson, whose character Ross, who's Tobin's dad, turns into a bit of a raging asshole, but there's kind of a reason for that. And sort of during the story, Becky's, I guess, ex-boyfriend, Travis, comes into the story, Harrison Gilbertson, and it kind of turns out that there's, like, within this field, there's, like, time loops. So, like, when the movie starts with Becky and Cal going into the field and they hear Tobin, you go back and see Tobin and his mom and dad get lost in the field and they hear Travis. But as we see, Travis didn't get into the grass until after Becky and Cal, so it's got this whole, like, time loop thing going on. It does kind of like mess with your head, which I really liked that it did, because I think it worked like for the film and what it was. But yeah, again, I liked that it was kind of had this Lovecraftian kind of element to it. And for me, I think the movie is better than what some people have said. Like, for me, I think it was pretty solid. I was entertained through it. I was definitely interested to see what was going to happen. So yeah, that's kind of like just my overall messy thoughts on the film. Bede, what about you? What did you think of In the Tall Grass?
I have to say I really enjoyed it. I could definitely see why it's had such a mixed reaction from a lot of people. Because to me, watching this film, I'm just going to say right now, I was very disappointed that this wasn't a stealth sequel to Children of the Corn. So upset.
Yeah, I know, right? It was Isaac and Malachi.
Exactly. I wanted my Malachi, I wanted my Isaac, I wanted all that stuff, and just someone saying, Outlander! But anyway, back to this movie. What I really did like about it is, like, it kind of reminded me of all those kind of Stephen King properties that were made in the 80s and 90s, you know, those kind of really batshit insane ones, like Sleepwalkers and stuff like that. Not at the extent of the insanity of that movie, but there are definitely things in The Tall Grass that kind of reminded me a little bit of that, just, you know, with a bit more focus. Like Patrick Wilson's performance is just so, like, he starts off being kind of a dickhead, but, you know, kind of just a, at least a likable enough dickhead, but then as, and also, you know, a reasonably good father. But then once he sort of, as the film progresses, like and the grass, or at least there's this, like, this giant rock thing that's in the middle of the field, and every time people touch it, they get consumed by it. And Patrick Wilson becomes evil from it. And his performance kind of dials up to about 11 because he's just so over the top and hammy. But it actually works for the story because...
It really works. Like I thought he was great. I always really enjoy him, but I liked that it was over the top. I thought it kind of suited what, like... whatever the rock grass things were, like how it consumed him to that point. Like, I liked that.
Yeah. And also like that it kind of like when I'm watching it, I'm just like, where's the story going? Because for like the movie kind of does take so many different turns. And the fact that like at first, you know, like they get lost in the grass, like, but they are lost separately and they can't find each other. I'm thinking, okay, how does this work? And then, as it goes along and once Becky's boyfriend comes into the picture, then you realize, oh, there's time loops in this as well, and, which is pretty cool. And Harrison Gilbertson, who, funnily enough, is also an Australian, and I know this because I've seen a lot of films he's been in, is he does a really good job as well. And, like, everyone does such a good job, and I kind of like all the things that it just throws at, like, you know, the big rock in the middle of the field, and also these kind of creatures that every now and again that kind of pop up throughout the film, like these grass kind of creatures with grass faces, and like it's such a weird, very weird little movie, and I like the fact
that those things were really weird. Just saying.
Yeah, and I like the fact that this film really goes for that very weird Stephen King vibe. But we all know, like, Stephen King can be really fucking nuts every now and again with his stories. And apparently not just him, but also his son Joe Hill as well. So the fact that some of these kind of really bizarre kind of elements are thrown into this movie, and the movie never really kind of delves into them that much, and I is kind of works as well, because, like I said, it's not, doesn't over-explain everything goes on. We're kind of discovering all this as the characters are. And I also like how, as sort of the film progresses along, it even starts to change people's personalities, or at least sort of bring out things about them, like secrets and that, to the open. Like, for example, the film kind of insinuates that Becky's brother, Cal, may actually have kind of incestual feelings for her, which I thought was pretty creepy. And yeah, I mean,
it's a throwback to Sleepwalkers.
Exactly.
With incest.
It is the two. This is the 2010s version of Sleepwalkers. Just
it is.
but overall, I did really enjoy In the Tall Grass. Like, it is a very crazy little movie, and I can definitely see why people had problems with it, especially that its tone is very inconsistent and its ideas are a little over the place. But for me, I think of the three, this one of films we talked about tonight, this one kind of feels like the most Stephen King, because this is Stephen King, and I would even say Joe Hill, at being over the top and very crazy with the material that they wrote. And
yeah, and definitely.
And it's definitely a lot of fun. And Vincenzo Natale did did a really good job with it. So overall, I think it's just a fun little Stephen King film.
Yeah, I agree. We'll throw it over to Tamika.
Okay. I think out of the movies that we've spoken about, we've discussed so far, I think I enjoyed this one the least. And that's not to say that I thought that it was a bad film or anything like that, because I definitely agree. It feels very much like Stephen King, like just unbridled. Just like, we're gonna throw in, you know, sentient grass, we're gonna throw in a rock, we're gonna throw in, like, I'm assuming like some sort of like ancient like mythology because of like the carvings on the rock. We're gonna throw in like time loops and all kinds of things, and but I, for some reason, it just didn't come together for me. I definitely, there were parts of the film that I enjoyed more than others. I really enjoyed the idea of the grass kind of changing everyone around, like moving the characters around. Because I always wondered why, if they're walking in a straight line, why they couldn't just retrace their steps and just walk back in a straight line and go back to the road and then explain there's some, like, you know, like some time manipulation going on. And so they get kind of disoriented and they get shifted around. And so that's why they're getting lost and they can't find their way back to the road. But I could not get on board with it the way I really wanted to, because I knew I could see it. I could see what it was going for. And I just wanted to be there. The little boy, I thought, did an incredible job. There's so many intense moments that require range, you know, because you could just kind of take it all to a 10 and kind of just stay there. But I don't think that would always work because the tone of the movie shifts around so much. So it was interesting that this little kid could kind of navigate the tones, and he could kind of, you know, be distraught and upset and crafty all at the same time. So I was very impressed by that. And I agree that the there was like a hints to maybe Cal being in love with, because there's a moment where he says to her that says to Becky, his sister, that he loves her, but it It wasn't like, I love you, like a sibling would say it. It was like, I love you. You know, it was like he was professing his love. And I just thought, ooh, that's creepy. Whoa. So yeah, it was creepy. It had its creepy moments, but not enough to really stick the landing. It makes me really sad. Maybe I need to watch it again, because that happens for me sometimes. Sometimes I have to watch things a couple times, and then it just kind of weaves its way into my life, and then I'm just stuck. I'm just in love. So maybe that needs to happen. I'm not sure. Please, somebody help me get to enjoy this movie, because I really want to like it.
I think it is one of those ones that can be a mixed bag, but I think, like, at least for me, I found more positives than negatives about it, and I, you know, just could enjoy it. Like, some of it was, like, really weird, and I'm like, oh, this is, like, what the hell? But I guess I kind of like those kind of things, and I like when not everything is, like, spoon-fed to me, and a lot of things are left ambiguous, and the kind of time loop thing, I had a feeling early on maybe that was going to be something, and then it was, and I think that kind of added to just more weirdness to it in a way. But yeah, it feels very Stephen King-ish and Joe Hill-ish. Like, I wouldn't complain if they write more stuff together. They do make a good team. Certainly not a movie that everyone's gonna like, but at least, like, for me, I liked it for what it was, and that's good enough for me, I suppose.
That's very fair. That's fair.
Yeah. I guess we'll wrap up our thoughts on the film and do ratings. So for me, it's probably 3.5 out of 5. For me, it was probably the weakest of the three, but I still quite liked it. And yeah, again, much love to Vincenzo Natali. I think he's awesome. Bede?
I have to agree as well, Marcy. I'm giving it 3.5 as well. Like, it is it's probably my least favorite of the three that we talked about tonight. But I still found it quite an enjoyable one, and one where I kind of just got caught up in the craziness of what it was showing on screen. And of course, like, in that regard, like, even though it definitely has its flaws, I still found it a lot of fun, and just enjoyed the kind of insanity that it was that it was showing throughout its 90-minute running time. And of course, you know, Patrick Wilson, of course, is always a delight to watch on screen. He's always great no matter what film he's in, and I love that he's been appearing in a lot of horror films over the past couple of years. But you can tell he's having an absolute ball playing a very evil character, and he's just enjoying the hell of it, and he finds that line of being very hammy and over the top as he's evil, but not being too over the top where it's, like, bad or anything like that.
He didn't quite reach Nicolas Cage levels of pure insanity.
Exactly. Although a part of me now wishes Nicolas Cage was in this movie now, or any Stephen King adaptation. Nicolas Cage could have been in Gerald's Game playing Jesse if he wanted to, if they changed the sex of the character. I could just see him, like, going total Cage rage as he's degloving his own hair, like, wow.
See, I think Nicolas Cage, like, Nicolas Cage of today, could really be Jack Torrance in The Shining.
Yes.
That would be insane.
Perfect. Okay. now I'm just going to imagine that for the rest of the day now. But yeah, overall, In the Tall Grass, a lot of fun. 3.5 from me.
And Tamika, your final thoughts and rating.
If Nicolas Cage had been in this film, I would have given it a 4.5. Oh, I want that so bad now. But Nicolas Cageless, I'm going to give it a 3, because I really do appreciate the themes. I think it is very on target for Stephen King, you know, outside of just kind of how over the top the premise can be. I like that it is about self-reflection. It is about the choices that we make and how we can either learn from our mistakes and take a better path, and that leads us to a better place in our lives, or in this case, like freedom. Or we can just keep running the rat race and the hamster wheel and just continue to make the same mistakes over and over again. But it just did not fully come together for me, which makes me sad. It breaks my heart, but it's okay, because I'm going to keep watching it, and we're going to see. And maybe I can envision Nicolas Cage in this, and then I'll boost it. It'll just take it right over the top.
It would.
Yes.
On a side note, I guess In the Tall Grass would make an interesting companion piece to Triangle, because I sort of thought about that movie a little bit. It has similar elements, and I think it sort of plays on some of the same things. Not, like, intentionally or anything, but I think they'd be good, like, back-to-back. But, yeah, just my opinion. Yeah, so that brings us to the end of our episode. So this is a wrap for episode 7 of The King Zone, the Netflix originals. I'd like to thank myself for hosting, and Bede for being the lovely co-host that he is. And, of course, Tamika for joining us on this episode. And thank you for being, I guess, a first-time guest on this show and dealing with all the craziness and technical difficulties. And as usual, we'll do our Where Can You Find Us? So you can find us at supermarcy.com. You can follow the official Twitter account at twitter.com/sm_supernetwork. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can join the Super Network Facebook page at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can join our group at the Super Network Facebook group. So just look up the Super Network and you'll find the group. You can email us at thesupernetworksm@gmail.com. And you can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, Castbox, and Spotify. Bede, where can people find you on the internet?
If people want to find me on the internet, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/bejamine, or my fan/writers page at facebook.com terribleaussie. And also you can also find me on Instagram as well, as under instagram.com/bejamine. And you can also find all my writings at supermarcy.com as well, with reviews, columns. And of course, you can also find my column Horror Down Under over at the screencast.com. And don't worry, I've got a new one coming out very soon. I've already spoken about that in the last few podcasts we recorded, but it is coming. It's just it's just been a very hectic month for me. So, but it is coming, and it will be for everyone's reading pleasure. And also, keep a lookout very soon for more reviews, and also my eventual top 10 list of 2019, which will be out in a few weeks. And once I get back from my trip, I am also going to write up my top 10 films of the decade as well. So I promise that
won't take forever. And I've already done that.
Yes. But you are a faster writer than me.
Yeah, well, it's my 10 favorites of the decade. I just picked one film from each year of the decade. Something I consider something I love, not that I necessarily consider the best. And I think probably my most controversial pick is what I picked for my favorite of last year. I don't think it's the best movie of last year. It's just the one that I probably adored the most. So you can check out those articles. And Tamika, if you so wish, where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. I am on the Twitter and the Instagram at Miss Tamika Jones, and you can find my writing at dailydead.com. I post horror highlights. Usually 5 days a week. And I also have a feature called Comics Corner, which goes up every Wednesday. I just cover all of the horror-related comics that are out that week. And sometimes, usually, about once a month, I'd say, I land a really cool interview with either a comic book illustrator or a writer. And those are a lot of fun. And I think that's it. I'm definitely going to read your lists because I'm excited for that. So it's supermarcy.com. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. It's written down. I'm excited. I can't wait to find out what your controversial pick is.
Yes. And of course, all the links are posted to my Twitter account because I am a whore for self-marketing, I suppose.
Okay. Also, I don't want to, for our listeners, I almost forgot. I always keep forgetting to mention this every time we do a podcast. If people want to, they're more happy to give us a rating or a review on iTunes, which would be pretty awesome. So, yes.
Yes, absolutely. And with that, we bid you farewell. And until the next podcast, I've been Marcy. Bede has been Bede, and Tamika has been Tamika, and we've been in the King Zone. Catch you later.
Yeah.
See you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
If you ever change your mind about leaving, leaving me behind, oh, bring it to me, bring your sweet loving, bring it on home to me, yeah,
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 yeah.
I know I laughed when you left, but now that ain't all I'll do for you.